Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:34 p.m. on Tuesday, March 7th, 2015. Present today we have Co-Chair Representative Newman, Vice Chair Representative Sadler, Representative Gaddis, Representative Pruitt, Representative Wilson, Representative Kawasaki, and myself, Representative Thompson. Before we start, please turn off your cell phones. They interfere with the recording equipment. On this afternoon's schedule, we'll have the introduction of two bills, House Bill 137, Hunting, Sport Fishing, and Trapping Fees by Representative Tallarico, and House Bill 118, Municipal Energy Improvement Assessment Bonds by request of the Governor. This is the first hearing for both of these bills, and I do not intend to move either of these out today. Our first bill up this afternoon is House Bill 137, an act raising certain fees relating to sport fishing, hunting, and trapping, raising the age of eligibility for a sport fishing, hunting, or trapping license exemption for the state residents to 65 years of age, requiring the state residents to purchase big game tags to take certain species, and providing for an effective date. Here to present House Bill 137 is the sponsor, Representative Tallarico, and his staff, Josh Banks. Gentlemen, please come to the table, begin your place yourselves on the record, and begin your presentation of House Bill 137. And we've been joined by Representative Edgemond and Representative Guttenberg. Go right ahead, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Dave Tallarico. I represent House District 6, and I have with me my staff member, Joshua Banks. House Bill 137 is really a response to calls from hunters, fishermen, outdoor groups, and the Department of Fish and Game to look into the license and tag fees for fish and game. There is a deficiency between the costs associated with management and research and the needs and the revenue that's brought in by the license and tag fees. The primary change that House Bill 137 makes is raising resident, non-resident, military hunting, fishing, trapping, and combination licenses to help deal with this deficiency. However, the most significant change in fees occurs in non-resident big game tag fees. House Bill 137 also limits eligibility for low-income license only to Alaskans that have a low annual income. The bill also creates a voluntary fish and game conservation decal that a person who does not hunt or fish can purchase in order to contribute to the conservation efforts in Alaska. The final change in the bill is to raise the eligibility for hunting, fishing, and trapping license exemptions from 60 years to the version that I have, 62 years. Also, residents under the age of 18 are exempt from having sport fishing, hunting, and trapping licenses, and non-residents under the age of 16 are exempt from having a sport fishing license. It's been over 17 years since many non-resident fees have been raised, and over 24 years since most resident fish and game fees have been raised. Though the fee increase in House Bill 137 will not match the increase in costs associated with fish and game management, this bill will help to ensure Alaskans can continue to enjoy the use of Alaska's abundant fish and game resources.
We've been joined by Representative Guerra.
Sorry.
Does the committee have any questions for Representative Tallarico or for Mr. Banks? We have quite a few. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just Representative Tallarico, just want to confirm this Bill 137 leaves intact the free hunting and fishing licenses provided for members of the National Guard, Territorial Guard, and disabled veterans. Just want to confirm that.
That is correct, yes.
Good. Thank you.
We also have other people in the room and online. We have Tim Brookover from the Department of Fish and Game. We have Deputy Commissioner Kevin Brooks, and we also have some industry people online to answer questions if you have any. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the only difference for residents, if I'm correct, is on low-income fees versus just is there a definition between those who can afford and not afford a hunting license or fishing?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there is we had actually set a number in there, and what it was is the poverty level for the a family of four, which is in the bill that you got from resources, which I believe is $29,820, is identified as the low income in the version that came from resources, and then the resident fees have gone up It's $5 for a fishing license, $5 for a hunting license. Trapping has gone up as well, but then the combo licenses actually provide a break. So an example would be the combo license that I have in my wallet, if this was put into place, would cost me an extra $6 from what I paid for my most recent license.
So follow-up?
Follow-up question, Representative Wilson.
So, I'm sorry, but $29,000 doesn't seem too poor. I mean, I guess it depends upon where you live. Is that what it is currently?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, currently the low income level is set at $8,200 for an annual income.
The follow-up, so why the huge increase?
Through the chair, it seems like, or at least to me, that the $8,200 I think must have been established quite some time ago. I don't have an exact pinpoint on the time. But we do have information from where our poverty level is set. You know, from the federal government has the poverty levels that are set. And like I say, that particular number that I have is poverty level income for a family of four. That was the number that we had selected. I would expect that is easily changed.
And final question.
Go ahead.
So do we have any kind of documentation that shows that at its previous number, how many people took advantage of that? And then the question on that, and you'll probably have to get it back to us, do we have any idea for other programs how many more people would be able to take advantage of the new number?
Through the chair, I do believe we have some of those numbers available, and I'm not exactly sure where they're located right at this particular point, but we do have some numbers, I think, potentially that Mr. Mulligan from Fish and Game might be able to add to that, or Mr. Banks.
Banks, place yourself on the record, and we'll hear your testimony, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Joshua Banks, staff to Representative Tyrico, and through the chair, Representative Wilson, in tab 7 of the binders that we provided the committee, the second page, we're looking at fishing license fees and projected revenue from the increases in HB 137, and you'll see on the second column, resident low income, high end trapping sport fish combo, and the 5-year average is just over 20,000 license.
We've also been joined by Representative Munoz. Welcome.
So just a
follow-up question, Representative Wilson.
So the 20,000 license, I think you said there was 20,000 licensing on the 8,000 set income. Is there any way that we could get a projection what it would be by raising it up to as high as what we're doing?
Mr. Mulligan, if you'd place yourself on the record, please.
For the record, my name is Ben Mulligan, legislative liaison for the Department of Fish and Game. If it's not premature, I would point to the resources fiscal note. On the second page, we do in the 1-4 paragraph, we lay that out. But what we did was we looked at the amount of households in Alaska. We used demographic information we got from the Department of Labor to figure out how many households would fit under that 29,820 level, took the average number of Alaskans per household, which is 2.92, extrapolated that out to that 137,240 individuals. And then finally, to try to figure it out, we took a percentage of how many Alaskans actually engage and buy a sport fishing license, which is 24%, which then you'd come up with a total new amount of people that would possibly buy a low income at 32,938, and then you minus that off the pre-existing, so you get to 12,748 potential new people would end up buying a low income license under the proposed House Resources Committee bill.
12,000 what?
12,748.
I can do the math from here. Thank you, sir.
I have a question myself. Does the current version, version P, generate enough revenue to support the department's operating costs in sport fisheries and wildlife conservation, which would replace current unrestricted general fund appropriations?
Representative Thompson, if you look at, again, at the fiscal note, you're looking at what the license increase right now would bring in, and potentially, you know, at the end after every kind of everyone sees the increase and then it slowly marches back up, you'll see a combined $6.49 million. Right now, general fund in each of the sport fish division and the wildlife conservation division sits just a little bit above $6 million respectively. So it wouldn't totally replace that money if we lost all general fund.
Okay. Okay, moving on, Representative Sadler, then Gaddis, Guerra, Kawasaki. So, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kind of teeing off that question, Mr. Mulligan, I was going to ask you, what does the extra money generated by these increased fees mean for the joint state-federal funding of wildlife conservation efforts department-wide?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, are you just speaking what would the extra funds be used for, just for wildlife conservation or both wildlife conservation and sport fish?
Both.
Okay. For wildlife conservation, you're looking at a combination of some of our intensive management activities that would occur that we would need Fish and Game Fund, also our ANILCA and Access Defense Program, and also, of course, we have Pittman Robertson money, federal aid money that is used for the match, and you've seen, and we've talked about it in this committee, the amount of money from ammo and gun sales is causing that portion of federal funds to increase at a dramatic rate, and we would use that as to the fullest extent possible to match those funds so we could do that also.
So my more pointed question is, if we raise more money by these fee increases and license increases, how much more federal money are we likely to get as a result of the Pittman-Robertson matching formula?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I couldn't give you an exact number because I'm not sure how, because some of the programs that we would want to fund through this, we would just use straight Fish and Game Fund because, one, either like when it comes to certain intensive management activities, you don't want to use federal funds, and then, two, some of them don't qualify for, certain aspects don't qualify for federal aid fund use. So I couldn't give you an exact number of how much we would leverage out of the increase, at least at this point in time, but I can get back to you.
Appreciate it.
Without raising our fees, are we in jeopardy of losing a lot of federal dollars because we haven't met our match or our amounts that we have to raise?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, right now, looking at the situation that we're in and combined with, you know, that we have a CIP that is going to try to leverage those funds so we don't lose them. But if we can't find matching fund by September of 2016, we may have to revert some of those back to the federal government.
How much? Yes.
Representative Thompson, that I don't know for sure. But
Perhaps we have an answer back here from Mr. Brooks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Fish and Game. In answer to a couple of the questions here, one, the federal funds, it's three federal dollars for one state dollar. So on just in rough terms, I think the current version of the bill that came from resources would generate $2.2 million on the hunting side. So that has potential to match 6.6 of federal aid dollars. We've seen almost a $10 million increase in federal aid funds from the 15 to 16 apportionment that we're looking at. And that was the reason for putting a very large capital project of about $11 million in our capital request this year to take advantage of some of those funds. But it is undermatched. Certainly this revenue would help to match that. It's a little bit more complicated, too, because we do have 2 years to obligate. And for the federal government, obligation is not an order of goods, but it's really an approved project. And so once we have approved project with identified match, we can obligate on the federal side. The danger we have is that if we get hit with another large increase between 16 and 17, which is not anticipated, I would say, we just don't know the size of it, that it's going to compound our ability to match. So it's a bit of a moving target, but we have far more federal funds right now that are coming in the door and that are really stretching our ability to match.
Okay. We have other questions, too. Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a lot of my questions related to the matching funds and to, quite frankly, so we're raising, and for those that are listening, we're raising these fees, and I would ask, what do the residents get out of this raising of the fees? So as they're listening, what is they're going to pay more, and I realize we haven't raised the fees in, I think, 17 years, Representative Tallarico indicated. But with that in mind, I hear matching funds and 3-to-1 ratios, but are we maximizing our matching funds with these raises?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, it's a very good question. The focus, it really, these intensive management programs that you've heard some talk about, they're really geared towards providing opportunity for hunters and also on the fishing side, but more specifically, the intensive management programs are focused on hunting and providing opportunity, lengthening seasons, and letting folks get out into the field and hunt and fill their freezers. So we want to continue those efforts. They have to be approved by the Board of Game. We also are recognizing that the $6 million or so of general funds that currently are appropriated within the sport fish and the wildlife budgets are vulnerable over the next few years. We would, it's probably not going out on a limb to say that. And so on the one hand, it would backfill some general fund cuts, but it would also help us continue those important intensive management programs that provide opportunity.
Follow up, Representative Gaddis.
Thank you. So I'm just going to try my best to put it in layman's terms. So I'm not really sure if I heard that it's enough funds or we need more funds. So this out of resources, could we have raised the fees and could we have done a better job of maximizing our match? Or are we maximizing our match now with the fee schedule that's in this House Resources bill?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, the current version of the bill would not match all of the federal funds available.
So it leads to the next question, is how much more would we need to maximize our match? And where I'm getting to is there's clearly some sweet spot, if you will, that we could raise our fees and maximize our returns, especially when we know that our general funds, we may need to backfill them elsewhere. So my bigger question is, should we or could we raise the fees in such a way that we will maximize those returns?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, we've taken a position of supporting this bill. We think it's important, but we think it's important also that the legislature and the sportsman groups come to a level of increase that's acceptable to them. And I think certainly the sponsor would have a strong opinion on where that number is, but we don't have a specific recommendation on the level that should be set at, and I really don't think it's the department's position to do that.
We do have people online that are from the industry, different support groups and sportsmen groups, professional hunter groups. So if you have any other questions that might be necessary to advance towards them, let me know. Representative Gaddis, you had a follow-up?
Well, and I think I'll hold them for the sportsmen's groups and the other folks. And I can appreciate your opinion that, you don't want to wade into this fray. But at the same time, what I am hearing you say is we're not maximizing our match. And I did hear that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tallarico,
could I respond
ahead
to that?
Yes.
Thank you. And through the chair, my intention here wasn't to try and recover all of the general fund money that would have been removed from fish and game. My real intention here is to make sure that we have the ability to fund the opportunity that's available for all of our hunters and sportsmen out there. My fear was is that, and this is a personal opinion, but if we fall short and we don't have the ability to collect data, we don't have the ability to do the particular surveys that we need to do and everything, whether it be intense management or just in any particular area, I think probably that we would be forced into a position to err on the side of caution. which means that, in my opinion, that means either shortened seasons or that means quotas to be met and cut these things off. And right now, we actually enjoy some reasonable seasons with opportunities for people to get out, you know, more than 10 days or more than one weekend. And so I'm really inspired here to try and get us to the level where we can continue to have what we currently enjoy with our seasons. The area I live in, we have one 25-day moose season. And quite honestly, for people that don't have enough seniority where they work maybe to get that opening weekend off, which you really can't unless you've got quite a bit of time, those are the late-season hunters. And if we can't do this the correct way, manage it the correct way, I think we probably have to move to a conservative way, and I think we start to lose opportunities for everyone. And I'm really inspired to hold on to those opportunities for the people that want to be out there in the field.
For the committee's information, we do have a coalition of user groups that are online. We have Ron Somerville from the Territorial Sportsman Incorporated, Eddie Grasser from the Legislative Outdoor Caucus Advisory Council, John Stacy from the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, and Rod Arno from the Alaska Outdoor Council, should you have any questions of them. Next up, we have Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few unrelated questions. Representative Tallarico, why is it important to raise the discount age for a king salmon stamp, and there's one or two other sections from age 60 to age 62? Why do we need to do that?
Through the chair, I really can't imagine myself getting a free license when I qualify, which I'll go ahead and admit is next year. And I really do think it's rather awkward for a person to bring this bill forward that's going to qualify for the free license next year. I'm planning on purchasing one as long as I'm available to get out in the field. I'm certainly not married to that provision, and if people think it should be age 60, I'm more than happy to do that. Honestly, I thought it was a little awkward for me not to move that when I'm going to be 60 years old and qualify.
Through the chair.
Go ahead, Representative Garrett.
Thanks. I understand then why you did it, but I think that might be one of those provisions that might cause some unhappiness. So I'll have to think about that. I understand you trying to stay away from your personal conflict, which I don't really think you have anyway. Then, let's see, is that a question? There's weird language in the law that you're not responsible for, so I won't blame you for that. But I would just note that on page 6, lines 6 and 8, just so folks know what our law says, a non-resident can either get a small game hunting license, which I guess would let you hunt for a small game, or a alien hunting license, which I guess would let you hunt for... And I'm not sure who wrote that, but it is more expensive to get an alien hunting license, though.
Hard to skin, too.
I had one other question, and I can't remember what it is, so I'll just come back. Thanks.
Thank you. Next, we have Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tallarico, there's been discussion of intensive management fees. Is that, I've been looking in the bill, where is that at in the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, we don't have, from the resource version, we don't have the intensive management fees in that particular bill. All we've done was raise the fees straight across, and we don't particularly have that in the resource bill.
Couple questions.
Follow up, Representative Newman.
Mr. Brooks, what is intensive management for game?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, intensive management is a method of management of wildlife approved by the Board of Game that designates a species for additional work, additional survey work, habitat manipulations to improve browse, and ultimately, if the numbers call for it, lethal removal of predators. So there's a broad definition of or a broad list of activities that are included under an intensive management program.
And Mr. Brooks, would the legislature and overseeing your budget have any say, or those are designated funds for intensive management? Would the legislature have any say where those would be designated to, and how they would be used?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, certainly that would be the case.
Even though they're designated funds.
Again, through the chair, so all these funds would go into the Fish and Game Fund, and between these Fish and Game Funds, which come from license revenue and our federal aid dollars, those are the funds that are appropriated to the Division of Wildlife Conservation for these activities.
That's one clarification, Mr. Chair. And a couple others. In conversations that I had with the director of Sport Fish, Mr. Swanton, we talked about right now our fishing license is $15, and there's a $9 surcharge that goes back to pay off the bonds for two new fish hatcheries, a Sport Fish and a salmon hatchery. And those I think we're going to be paid off around 2020 or so, and somewhere in there. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, the total bonds currently have a expiration or a repayment of 2026, but we've been doing early redemptions, and it's, you know, every year we're paying some of those older issues off early. So 2021 is probably slightly ambitious, but it's not far from where we would see it coming down.
And just for the members, I oversee the fish and game budget, and what it is the $9 surcharge for the two hatcheries. It was approved, I don't know, several years ago when we built the hatcheries. But we've been, the department gets to take $500,000 out of that. They collect more money on the $9 than it costs for the bonds. So the department gets to collect $500,000 out of that for Division of Sport Fish. And the extra money this year anyhow, since I've had a budget, is to put that money to pay the bonds down so they can get paid off faster. And then what I would like to see eventually in this bill is, instead of an increase in the fishing license, to be able to take that $9 that people are used to paying now, because you pay $24 when you go get a fishing license, is to be able just to fold that in there and have that lapse back over to the department, so there wouldn't be an increase in the fee per se, but the department would get the full additional $9, which is a substantial amount of money. How much money is it cost right now for the bonds?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, the surcharge, I think getting to your question specifically, it generates in the area of $6.5 to $7 million a year. And there is a sequence is set in the appropriation bill that pays the debt first, pays the $500,000 piece in the sport fish budget, and then additional funds go to pay down. We paid $850,000 in early redemptions, the last payment.
Right. So if I may continue on, Mr. Chair. So if we lapse that $9 right now, that's a surcharge, the department would get an additional $6 to $7 million under, I mean, obviously, if people continue to buy the same amount of fishing license we're talking about, they would have that.
That's correct.
Okay, and then there's another piece of legislation that's moving through that deals with the Commercial Fisheries Entries Commission. What we did this year in this budget is, instead of that CFEC, Commercial Fisheries Entries Commission, having a separate appropriation, we moved under the department. So the appropriation had moved to the department to get some management on that. There's about $3.5 million in excess permit fees from CFEC that's collected. They collect the commercial fishing license and stuff, but there's excess funds that they collect out of that. And those generally get designated towards research programs for enhancement. I'm glad to say it's enhancement of fisheries that everybody gets to take advantage of, not just commercial fisheries, but subsistence, personal use, and sport fisheries also. Obviously, if there's more salmon or other fisheries out there, it benefits everybody. But this year, the department will have access to about that $3.5 million that they didn't have before that they can blend into their research programs also, because the department spends quite a bit of money on research trying to make sure that we have good fisheries. We're pretty well renowned in the state of Alaska for having good management of our fisheries. And so they'll have an additional $3 to $3.5 million on top of that. Is that correct, Mr. Brooks?
Well, it's a new funding source. It's not additional money. It offset general fund cuts. Right.
Other designated funds that you'll have access to that
correct.
You can target towards fisheries management programs that the department would have, say, oversight eyesight in.
That's correct.
Okay.
Through the chair.
So that's what I'm getting to, is, Mr. Chair, is there's about $3.5 million there, about $7 million that they're going to get extra from additional sport fishing. So that's, I have a little bit of issue with an increase in the fishing license because they're going to get some extra funds there. So I just wanted to make sure that we pointed out to the committee members the funding sources that they currently have and where they flow through and how they flow. As an avid outdoorsman, I get it. And I spend a lot of time going out with the biologists. I go out on salmon surveys, moose surveys, accounts like that, and to talk to the biologists. I think that they need the funds, but there's just a couple areas that I think we need to take a look at, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just for some more information for the committee, our indirect expenditure report that we had commissioned and we received this year for resident seniors, how much money are we forgoing per year? This bill that gave seniors over 60 years of age the free hunting, fishing, trapping license, et cetera, king salmon stamp, duck stamp, the department estimates that we have foregone about $6 million worth of revenue on that program. That's not an accurate picture, because that's assuming that all 77,866 people in 2013 would have bought a license. But still, it's a lot of money that was enacted back in 1981 and has not been addressed. They figure that it's a $77 savings to seniors through this period of time. So that's one of the reasons I think that we need to continue to take a look at that. But anyway, that was just some information to put out there. Next we have Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. This is very helpful. The sheet, it's like a multi-page, and it shows the current statute and then version H and version P. And then a couple questions on that. The fourth line, which is outdoor caucus, is that, can you explain what that group is or what that fourth line is on the?
Through the chair, for the record, Joshua Banks. Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, the title outdoor caucus, those are the numbers that the coalition of sportsmen groups, the territory sportsmen's, the Alaska Outdoors Council, I'm not sure if that coalition has a official name, but I know a number of the groups are in the outdoor caucus, the legislative outdoor caucus.
Okay, and then follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned at the beginning that the resident hunting, fishing, trapping licenses are going up a little bit, but the big ones that are being added to are the non-residents. There is a ledge legal memo dealing with the differential between non-resident and resident, and that you can actually have a differential for a non-resident because it has to deal with game. It mentions in that particular brief that there's one that was upheld in Montana where the differential between the non-resident and the resident was 25 times larger. Can you comment on that?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, we requested the legal opinion just to see if there was a threshold that we could meet or that would go over the State v. Carlson, and turns out that the Carlson case doesn't even apply to this bill. And the legislative legal provide additional information, and so in particular the Montana case, but we haven't discussed going quite that high that Montana has
has gone. And then follow up.
Follow up, Representative Kawasaki.
I guess are these do these hunting and fishing resident versus non-resident generally conform with hunting and fishing licenses and the differential between the two in other states?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I don't. We didn't. You know the old saying: we don't really care how they do it outside. I know that my opportunity to take a game animal in the state of Wyoming, which is smaller than some dogs I have owned, would be about the same as what we would ask for a new moose tag if we move forward with these for a non-resident. So it varies, I know, in the lower 48 states quite a bit. And they do it, sometimes it's a little different from state to state. License fees vary substantially and tag fees. And in a few of them, even in different regions, they have different costs for tag fees.
I guess just follow up. I guess follow up. For the, I mean, you know, to the extent that we can have residents not have to pay it versus non-residents who are coming in, I think that would be preferential for me. And then I had another question along that line, and I don't know if there's somebody else that can answer it, but has there been any sort of a study done or discussions with groups that if these non-residential tags or fees are too high, whether that would negatively impact the number of people that come to Alaska to hunt or fish generally for those particular species?
Mr. Brooks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki. We actually do have some information that compares the cost to hunt and fish with the western states, which is the closest comparative. It's not uncommon for states to charge a premium for non-residents coming in. I think we've heard one example in previous committees that to hunt a mule deer or an elk in Oregon is like $2,000 for a non-resident. But I think Thor Stacey, one of the individuals that's going to be presenting to the committee, could certainly talk to you extensively on the threshold that non-residents are willing to pay. The folks coming from out of state to hunt in Alaska are spending a lot of money to get here. They're often guided. I think they've done some analysis on the price point that's appropriate and what kind of increase could be tolerated and accepted by the hunting public.
And then one other question, on a different item. On Section 19, the Fish and Game Conservation Decal, which is new language, the $20 voluntary fee or voluntary thing, I guess they get a sticker, and we charge them $20. The $20 fee, since it's voluntary, I guess I'm trying to figure out, does that just go back into the Fish and Game Fund or the General Fund? And for what use would the department have for that, the income from that fee? Or would it just be everything the department wants?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, as currently written, the revenue would go back into the General Fund. It's a Fish and Wildlife Conservation Stamp. I think its genesis was from Representative Seaton's district. One of his constituents had the idea where folks who don't necessarily harvest fish and wildlife still might want to contribute to the management of the resources and habitat types of activities. And so the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Decal was kind of a result of that inquiry and suggestion. The Fish and Game Fund is dedicated for hunting and fishing license revenue because it's a requirement of the federal government, and the fund was around its statehood, so it's a dedicated fund by that. Because of that, I don't believe the decal revenue would qualify for that dedication. There are probably ways that it could be deposited into the Fish and Game Fund. It could be a statutory designated program receipt, other ways that it could be identified for those types of conservation functions within the department.
Cool. Thanks.
By the way, I did back and was going to suggest that $20 decal because at my age, even with this raise, I have my free license. I feel like I should be paying something. So, yes, I was very much in favor of seeing that. Next, we have Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, before we get too deep in the details, I do want to commend the sponsor and the department for working with the outdoors organizations to wrangle the cats necessary to do this. I think it is kind of coming together in a willingness to pay more for conservation is in the finest traditions of outdoorsmen who deep into their own pockets to pay for conservation. And I just want to commend all involved for coming to this great compromise. Also, I just want to acknowledge that the fee increases are not as high as they could have been if you're going on a straight inflation-adjusted basis. So you're leaving some cash on the table. You're not being greedy. And likewise, to the co-chair, my family buys a parking pass every year, though we don't camp out anymore. So here's one more place you're going to give me the opportunity to voluntarily support the state of Alaska. So thank you, I think.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Next, we have Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tallarico, would you, so just on the change of age from 60 to 62 before you get the discounts on the various licenses and tags, would you have any problem just so it's not the biggest deal in the world, right? But it's going to rub some people the wrong way. Would you have any problem phasing that in with licensing starting in 2017 so people have a little bit of notice on that?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I'm certainly open to that. I wouldn't have a problem with that at all. I'll say that I have a tremendous amount of respect for this committee and the committee members, and I know that they have a tremendous amount of experience and the institution as well. So I appreciate the committee process and that question. I have no problem with that at all.
Probably too much respect for all of us. But I appreciate it.
Yeah,
all your questions, Representative Guerra, seem to be talking about how old are you?
Mr. Chair,
you didn't hear you laugh.
I feel like I age about a year a day around here.
The follow-up question, Representative Guerra?
No.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I saw my colleague's hand up first, but I'll go ahead. I got no problem going in front of her. With that being said, since we talked about the license, and I have talked to the bill sponsor about my thoughts on this, we have a lot of folks that have been here a long time, been hunting, been paying their hunting licenses, fishing licenses for years. Whether it's 60, 62, or quite frankly, it's 65, my thought is that those folks, they're still hunting. They're willingly paying. It's an honor to have the free license, but it's an honor to be able to still be able to hunt, to be healthy enough to get out there and hunt. So since we're talking about potentially raising it to 62, I'd like to have the conversation to raise it to 65. I don't think it's as big a challenge as I think that a lot of people think that it is. I think that Alaskans recognize, have been paying, and I kind of wonder how we acknowledge if you're a snowbird and you go out, but you have that license and you don't have to renew it yearly. I mean, I kind of wonder if we could tie it to being PFD eligible as well. And I don't know how that's done, but, you know, if you have a license that's good forever, I don't know how you determine whether you're still a resident. Do you cross-reference it with your driver's license? I'm not sure how that's done. So there's a few questions I have on how we deal with that.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, in answer to the question, currently the way the PIDs are issued, you're correct, Rep. Gaddis, it's a lifetime benefit. And the way the statute is currently written, once issued, it's irrevocable. You have to maintain your residency, but we don't go out and check that. When we issue new ones, we do check it against the PFD database. So that's the first check we do, and we immediately send those out. And if someone didn't get a PFD, we send them a letter, ask them for some other proof of residency, you know, utility bills or something like that would show a presence in the state.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to make sure on the low-income one that I'm looking at this right. So are we talking about the $5 fee? Is that just for, because it's underneath the resident hunting, trapping, and sporting fishing license? So they'll get a full license for all those that others will be paying $60. We're dropping that down to $5 if you make around $29,000. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct.
And I just think we need to have a look at that, because if we even just split it in half to where it was, you know, half as much, that's a difference in revenue of $382,440 versus $63,740 at the $5. And that's based on the old fiscal note. That's why I missed it before instead of the new one that has that calculation in it. I just think it's worth a discussion on whether or not at that rate that people, some are going to be paying $60 and others $5. I think that's going down a little far. And one other question, Mr. Chair. And if somebody sent me this note based on the old version, so maybe it's not in the new version because I can't find it. So this is basically talking about the Board of Game and making regulation reduce or eliminate the resident tag and fee for musk ox for all or a portion of a game management unit. Is that still in here? Because I can't find it.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Joshua Banks, through the chair, Representative Wilson. I believe that was based on the original bill,
version H,
where we originally proposed creating resident big game tags, which in the resources committee substitute we took out. And so if the committee has version H, it's on page 3. I believe the language that Representative Wilson is looking at is on page 3.
So to make it easier, so is it in the new version?
Version P.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, no.
Then I have no question. Thank you.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. I just wanted to start a conflict. I have my Jesus card with me.
Right. Objection. You're next.
Maybe for Mr. Brooks. Thank you. Those eligible for the $5 license now, do you have any way of knowing or keep track of those who get some of the big game tags? So I guess my question is, do people that are getting the $5 license because they're on an assistance program now also participate in big game hunting?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, we have very few resident big game tags. We have a brown and grizzly bear tag. It's something we could check and get back to. Most of these big game tags apply to non-residents, and so the $5 license, I want to say that's a resident license, but I'd have to check that as well. I'm sorry, I'm not able to answer that right here at the table.
Okay. Yeah. Representative Edgman.
Thanks. I just want to say that I'm still learning about the details of the bill, but I know that a lot of work has gone into this, a lot of balancing of interests, and I want to commend the sponsor for bringing this bill forward and others in the audience for their work on this, because I think a lot of behind-the-scenes work has gone into bringing these numbers together. I would say I'm going to keep an open mind in terms of any sort of suggestions about changing any of these fees. I think just my first glance is most of them seem to be pretty commensurate with what an increase either in 17 or 24 years would stipulate. But I do, I guess offhand, think that the 60 years of age, I think back to, you know, where I'm from and all the people that are 60 years old, and been fit, a lot of these guys and gals are pretty healthy and pretty capable of getting out there and certainly paying, like both of you have said, a nominal fee to enjoy the great opportunity to hunt and fish and, you know, in Alaska. So I think that's something, kicking that up to 65 might be something that I'd like to take a closer look at as we go forward. So thanks.
Thank you. And seeing no further questions from the committee, Representative Tallarico, do you have any final remarks?
Mr. Chairman, thank you so much for the committee for hearing the bill today. We have some recommended amendments that if the chair would allow, we would like to get those to the committee members. I do appreciate the opportunity to come and present this bill today quite a bit. And even though Representative Guerra didn't compliment me on how good I look for my age, I will say that, Representative Guttenberg, you look very good for a guy who's got that, that permanent card. We do appreciate that. I will let you know that there is no doubt that this bill brings with it its own controversy, for sure. And we got it out early, and we distributed it around to people so that we could really, really get it sounded out with a lot of folks. And just once again, I would like to reiterate that it wasn't really inspired to replace general funds that we might be losing, but the inspiration behind the bill is to make sure that Alaskan outdoorsmen do not lose their opportunities that we currently are able to provide to them. I think that's very critical. And if I could point out one change that I really am married to is in Section 20 of the bill. We have changed the age, and this particularly, I think, impacts families, in particularly low-income families, that rather than having to purchase a license if you're a resident at 16 years of age, we've moved that up until what I think we would normally consider you're out of high school, so that 16 and 17-year-olds would be able to enjoy the outdoors if they so desire without having to purchase a license. And I have heard from a lot of people that that's pretty important to a family of four when they have a 17-year-old to be able to do that. So once again, Mr. Chairman, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Tallarico. At this time, I'm going to set House Bill 137 aside. We will hear this bill again on Friday, April 10th. Where I believe there will be a CS, and also we will be taking public testimony at that time. And if it's the will of the committee, we will at that time pass House Bill 137. Okay. Our second bill up today is House Bill 118, an act adopting the Municipal Property Assessed Clean Energy Act, authorizing municipalities to establish programs to impose assessments for energy improvements in regions designated by municipalities, imposing fees, and providing for an effective date. This bill is by request of the governor. Here to present House Bill 118 is Gene Theriault, Deputy Director of Energy Policy for the Alaska Energy Authority, and Emily Ford, Public Outreach Liaison. Mr. Theriault, Ms. Ford, please place yourselves on the record and begin your presentation. I understand we do have a PowerPoint.
You've cleared the room, Gene.
Just not as sexy as fishing game licenses, I guess. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the time today before the committee. My name is Gene Theriault, director at Alaska Energy Authority. Ms. Ford will be walking you through the PowerPoint presentation, which is a visual way of going through a sectional analysis, but I would like to just make a couple of points before she does so. In 2010, the Alaska legislature established a number of energy goals for the state. One of those was to have an increase in energy efficiency across the state of 15% by the year 2020. We have a number of programs that operate. AEA operates in conjunction with AHFC on weatherization, energy efficiency rebates offered by AHFC, an energy efficient energy efficiency means to assist with public buildings and municipal buildings in the state. But one of the areas that we found that we are lacking is programs that help private businesses achieve energy efficiencies at their businesses. And we know from a statewide survey that it was done, I believe, by AHFC, that a tremendous amount of square footage in the state of Alaska is, of course, owned and operated by private businesses. So it represents a huge portion of the energy that is used on a yearly basis. The Alaska Energy Authority operates a commercial energy audit program. Through that program, we assist with the expense of businesses actually undertaking, having somebody come in and assessing their individual business and making suggestions on how they can improve the energy efficiency of their operations. Through that program, we have helped businesses do energy audits at about 170 individual businesses across the state. For those businesses that then follow through and implement the suggested changes to the operations, they're generally able to achieve about a 30% reduction in their yearly energy expense. So we know there are tremendous savings there. However, we're not seeing businesses actually follow through to make the suggested improvements. When I met with Representative Wilson yesterday, she asked if we had something more than just anecdotal evidence. We actually have done a survey of those people that have gone through the energy audits, and the responses that we have gotten indicate that financing to make the improvements is a significant hurdle for businesses to follow through. Through my membership with the National Association of State Energy Officials, I recently was elected to their board of directors. I then engaged with individuals from across the nation who are involved in doing innovative things at their individual state level to help with energy costs in their state, and became aware of a growing number of states that are using what is called PACE financing, that is property assessed clean energy financing, to actually help businesses to clear that hurdle, make the investment in their business, and capture those energy savings. The legislation that is before you today is patterned after a rewrite of the Texas PACE statute, which they passed last year. After engaging with a number of officials through the NASIO organization, I figured that following a state like Texas, which is very pro-business, wanted to make it very clear that it was not going to be a program that the state was going to fund, but it was a tool that they wanted to allow local governments, local businesses, and local lenders to potentially take advantage of to help encourage energy efficiency at the local level. It's my understanding, and in fact I know Senator Egan explored the PACE mechanism a number of years ago, and I believe Representative Edgman and his staff, when he was very involved in energy policy here in the state, had looked at the mechanism, but we just really hadn't pushed forward yet. Now with the state dollars tightening, understanding that the state's ability to continue to help with energy efficiency, and you know the thought that we won't have money to really push forward with funding to help businesses, we really do want to look at mechanisms that, again, at the local level, the local government, local lenders, local businesses can put into place to help achieve the suggested savings. As Ms. Ford goes through the sectional analysis, I'll try and jump in to highlight a number of the protections that are put into the bill. It is a local option for the local government. The businesses cannot be coerced into using the tool. Any existing bank that has a mortgage on a facility has to give permission before PACE financing is done, because their mortgage will actually be bumped to a second tier lien. The PACE financing will be a superior lien. And so we have a protection in here for local lenders that currently have mortgages that they have to agree that is a smart thing to be done for the property that collateralizes their loan, and that they see that it's a sensible thing to move forward. So again, patterning our suggested legislation after Texas, we wanted to capture all of those protections, and I believe they are in the bill, and I'll highlight those as we go through it. And with that, I think I'll turn it over to Ms. Ford so we can get through the...
Before we start with that, I think Representative Guerra has a question. Have you,
Mr. Dario? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Gene. I just have a... this is a very important suggestion. So I'm looking at the acronym, and I don't really like it that much, PACE. But I think the acronym would be much better if you did local energy savings. That would be an acronym that would work a lot better for me. With that, I think everything's okay.
You want more savings, more than not less.
Thank you,
Ms. Ford, place yourself on the record and go ahead with your PowerPoint presentation.
For the record, my name is Emily Ford, Energy Policy and Outreach Manager, and I actually almost got hung up there because PACE is my maiden name, so I almost introduced myself as Emily PACE there.
Oh, I get the conflict.
So.
You lose less.
Okay. So as Mr. Terrio had gone over, commercial property assessed clean energy programs allow commercial property owners to finance qualifying energy efficiency improvements over time through a voluntary assessment on the property tax bill. There's voluntary participation by both the municipalities and commercial building owners. Mortgage holder consent is also required before applications are approved and assessments are placed. And improvements can include lighting upgrades, renewable energy, conversion to natural gas, high efficiency boilers, and additional energy efficiency improvements. And then the repayment obligation transfers with the sale of the property. Energy efficiency upgrades are financed with capital secured by a primary lien on the property. lower interest capital and favorable repayment terms can be raised from the private sector, and this allows for longer repayment periods so the building owner can recognize immediate operating savings while still repaying the debt. Traditional lending sources and local banks can be used, and as Mr. Terrio referenced, in Alaska, this provides consistency with state energy policy and goals. 31 states have already created PACE programs, and the state legislatures must provide the authority for local governments to use this, essentially an expansion of taxation process. And the municipalities create the program consistent with the new statute and then select the financing models that work best for the community. And there are a lot of national organizations for communities who may choose to operate a PACE program, including marketing materials, tools for local lenders, and also municipalities. In researching the different types of PACE programs across the United States, there's really a wide spectrum of options for local governments to use. For those states that have large energy efficiency priorities, lots of times they have green banks or they have energy efficiency utilities, there are very local government-driven processes where there are separate PACE offices and there are government offices designed to market the program and interface with local lenders and commercial property owners, and primarily bond financing is used. On the other side of the spectrum, there's very private sector-driven models, and those are called the Main Street models, actually what's been developed where the local assessor's office primarily absorbs the additional workload, and they leave it to the local lenders in the commercial sector to market the program. The most popular model tends to be the hybrid model, where really this is another tool in the toolbox, and you identify all the different potential funding sources to include bonds, existing revolving loan funds, and then private capital. So the bill in front of you, House Bill 118, is authorizing legislation for local governments who collect property taxes to choose to create a PACE program and allow commercial property owners to opt in. And this is where we'll begin just a brief sectional analysis of the bill itself. Sections 1, 2, and 3 amend existing statute to allow home rule municipalities, first-class boroughs, and second-class boroughs to opt in or engage in an area-wide PACE program.
And for the committee members, because the PACE refinance or repayment is an additional voluntary assessment that goes on the property tax payment, although this is a statewide statute, it really is only available to those municipalities that actually issue property tax. Of course, if there's an area or municipality that doesn't currently, you know, if they did move towards issuing a property tax statement, they would be able to avail themselves of the PACE mechanism at that time.
Section 4 adds a new chapter to Alaska Statute 29. So this would be Chapter 49, Municipal Property Assessed Clean Energy Act. 010 allows municipalities to exercise powers under the judicial review statute. 020 authorized assessments would allow for a property tax assessment to be added to the financing of qualified projects, and this is on real property, so it can't be on vacant lots or property that's undergoing development at the time, and it's not to finance temporary measures or products and anything that's not permanently affixed to the property. 030 requires a written contract between the local government and the record owner of the real property.
And 030 actually is one of the first protections. That's a voluntary contract that the property owner enters into with the local government to place that assessment on their tax bill. Later on, there's a provision that prevents the local government from doing anything to try and coerce that owner into entering that contract. They can't withhold any license or permit or things of that nature.
Would you like questions as we go?
If that's your preference, that would be fine.
All right. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Mr. Chair. To that point, what is certainly you don't want to have a situation where a municipality is trying to hold some property owner hostage. Is there any sanction or is there any enforcement teeth for that? What if the property owner who declined to opt in finds himself feeling like he's being pressured to do so by having a permit withheld, a zoning variance withheld, no snowplow in front of his building, whatever?
Well, the language says that, you know, there can't be any permit that is withheld. I guess if the property owner felt that he can make the case that, in fact, he's being singled out somehow, he would be able to take that to the local assembly We don't have a sanction that's built in at this time, but there is clear language that says to the local communities, you know, thou shalt not do that.
Page 10, line 10, is where the prohibited acts that talks about the coercion provision, and then also contracts and written approval are required by not only the building owner, the mortgage holder, the local government, and the finance source as well. So it's a very public process that all three parties have to go through in order to implement the program. 040 establishes the program and authorizes local government to choose to establish a commercial PACE program and enter into a contract with a property owner. And if third-party financing is used, the municipality, the third-party financer, and the real property owner must all enter into a contract. And the assessment imposed may cover some of the costs for the commercial property owner as well, including permits, lenders' fees, administration, and some engineering costs. 050 talks about the applicability of the program. And so if the municipality chooses to participate in the program, they're required to implement it on an area-wide basis. Cities within a borough are allowed to opt out of a program, but it also leaves the option open that a future assembly may choose to opt into the program at a later date.
And Mr. Chairman, that was a change that was made by the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. Number one, that the program, if it's going to be used area-wide. There was some concern that would the local assembly designate a particular area of their jurisdiction that would get the benefit at the expense of another. I don't think that's the way the local government would have worked, but they felt that more comfortable that if they want to use it, it needs to be available to all. However, using the example of Fairbanks North Star Borough, if the borough decided they wanted to offer PACE, and keep in mind it's voluntary, no business within the borough would be required to use it, but for whatever reason, if the city of North Pole chose that, you know, they just didn't really think it was a fit for them, they would be able to opt the city of North Pole out of the program. That means that the PACE financing would not be available within the city. I'm not sure why they would do that, but it is their option, just preserving the power of that local government to opt out. But as Ms. Ford indicated, if they chose to opt out now, but years later the city council decides that they want to get in, there is a provision for them to opt in at that time.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Gene. I'm very supportive of this, but I do have one question I hadn't thought of earlier, and seeing it come up now. What's to prevent a business owner from getting an energy audit, which I would assume they would have to do something in this program to qualify, and then just going to the bank and showing a calculation on savings and getting a loan to do those energy efficiency programs now and just not need this bill? Or is this this language needed regardless?
Certainly, to the representative's question, certainly once an energy audit is done, if the building owner believes that they can get financing directly from the bank, they could certainly choose to do that. However, if they do want to follow through with PACE, there is the requirement that the audit be done, that a calculation on the expected savings be done to show that if the loan is secured through PACE, that it can be repaid, and in doing so, there still are savings for the business. So by going through all of that, you really lower the risk of any defaults. You've got the collection power of the property tax. The assessment can't be discharged by the property going through bankruptcy. So really, in order to lower the risk, hopefully lower the interest rate than that is applied to the money that is loaned out, offer a longer period for repaying, just like on your personal mortgage. If you stretch that 15-year mortgage out to 30 years, you know, your yearly cost is going to be that much lower. We really want to try and set up a mechanism that the private business can make the improvements and see immediate positive cash flow because they have done it using this mechanism. And those same provisions might not be available by just going directly to the bank.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Brief question. I should maybe know this, but is there any situation where a municipality did not have the authority to impose property taxes that would want to be able to collect these assessments? I guess I don't know enough about local government to know that. But
I believe the state law has to be amended to actually give them the power to place that assessment on the bill.
Representative Kawasaki.
Just a clarification, Gene. You keep talking about commercial property, but is this limited to commercial only?
It is limited to commercial. Across the nation, when PACE was first started, it was a blend of commercial and residential. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac actually sued a number of jurisdictions to stop the residential because they're a major buyer across the nation of secondary or residential mortgages in the secondary lending market, and they were not interested in being put in a secondary position. So for the most part, across the nation, jurisdictions have stopped their residential PACE and focused on business. There are a couple of jurisdictions that are trying to figure out a way to continue with residential. In many of the areas, what they've had to do is sort of strip the PACE financing from residential of having that senior lien, which is one of the major benefits. They have to require that the PACE financing be paid off at the time of the sale of the residence, which the ability to stretch it out over a long period of time, and the current residence pays for their share, the next residence pays for their share, is, again, one of the major benefits and things that are attractive. So they've had to really strip out a number of the positive things to try and move forward with residential, and still Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac continue to send out notices saying, if, in fact, there's a residential property that has a PACE financing, they're not going to purchase those in the secondary market. So we chose, because we've got this gap with financing for businesses, to just restrict this to businesses.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Dara, if you're off your cell phone, we'll have your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in time, I was actually working on an acronym that spelled Guttenberg, and I was struggling.
Did you come up with one?
No. Thank you. Through the chair, Gene, so right now we have energy efficiency programs for low-income housing. We have energy efficiency programs for housing. We have energy efficiency programs for public housing units. But, I mean, the one gap that we have, other than we can get an audit to private businesses, is that there's nothing available out there right now for private businesses. Is this the one gap that you're trying to fill?
That's correct.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson, then Representative Munoz.
So the only part I can't really get around on this is that, you know, it still feels like we're again competing with banks. I mean, I can't imagine if you went to a bank, and especially if you had an audit and you show the savings and, you know, and all the rest, and you're a good business, you're paying your mortgage, that wouldn't be an avenue to go versus this. So convince me why we want to compete with the banks.
I think the fact that there's that surety of repayment and very low default rate because of the collection mechanism and the ability to stretch the payments out perhaps beyond what a regular commercial loan will allow. Those are the two benefits. And because there is the allowance for the local government to either through bonding, not geo bonding, but revenue bonding, collecting up a pool of money that can be lent, they can partner with local lenders to service those loans, or the local government can actually partner with local lenders to provide the capital to be loaned out. It doesn't have to be the local government coming up with the money. They're just providing the mechanism for the collection. The banks really are not cut out, and we do have a provision that I mentioned earlier that if the bank currently has a mortgage on the business, they have to give permission, so they feel like, you know, that before they get bumped to a less than, you know, senior lien, they've got to give permission. They feel comfortable, and actually the Alaska Banking Associations, as long as that protection mechanism stays in, has indicated that they don't oppose the legislation.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
And it was my understanding, though, that Commerce also has some type of loan to private businesses. I thought that you had mentioned that there was some other mechanism, although maybe not this, but that there was something available to private businesses. Did I misunderstand?
Yes, there is a loan program in the Department of Commerce. However, since this was established, the hurdles to actually access those loans are such that we really have not seen any uptake of that. And of course, with very tight dollars, we're not sure, you know, how long that will continue. And our view was that this is a mechanism that local governments can control. We're not promising any money, but it's the mechanism itself that really provides the benefit.
I just wanted to prove I was right, that there was something else out there. Thank you.
Representative Munoz and then Representative Sadler. Representative
Thank
Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm just trying to understand. So the local government makes the tax assessment. Does the local government cover the tax assessment, guarantee the tax assessment? And why, if you could help me understand how this tax assessment is going to help the development of that property.
Mr. Chairman, it is an extra assessment that's put on the tax bill. But that's just so that you get that the collection ability along with the property tax. So it doesn't become part of the property tax. That's unaffected. It's just an additional line that is added then of a voluntary assessment that the property owner has agreed to have placed on their yearly tax bill. The local government then collects that money up and then uses it to pay back the bond if they have bonded for a pool of money, or they use it then under a contractual arrangement, then they hand that money off to Wells Fargo if that's the local lender that provided the money. Either the local government provides the money or it could be a local lender. Once the money is collected by the local government, then the money is then handed off to whoever funded the original loan.
Follow up.
It's the municipality then that's dealing with the lending agency and not the property owner?
The municipality, under a contractual arrangement, has an obligation to collect up the money and then hand it back to the bank if, in fact, a local bank, private, has lent the money out.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along those lines, Mr. Terrio, what happens? I understand that this allows for a private lender bank to have to sign off to take a secondary position, secondary lien. What happens if the property owner defaults on his payments to the for his PACE improvements?
Well, if they've defaulted on paying the tax bill at all, then there's the whole collection.
Right, not the tax bill. What if they actually send in money to the tax bill but do not pay off their PACE assessment?
Then the local government has the same collection power to collect that assessment as they do the local property tax. That, again, is one of the reasons why the defaults are really low. The bank is assured, whether it's the bank or the local government that provided the funds to be paid out, they're assured that they're going to be repaid.
This is going to sound self-certain. I've never not paid my property taxes, so I don't know what power local government has to enforce that collection.
They have big ones.
They
own your house.
Okay, they can take your house. Okay, very good. If
go ahead, Ms. Ford. Yes,
The PACE program operates in states outside of Alaska. Okay, great. Primarily, is the financing come through private lenders, banks, or from municipal bonds issued? And what would you anticipate that the source would be for funding in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, it really depends on the type of, value system that the state had already created. There's a lot of, states on the East Coast, Vermont, Connecticut, that have established very aggressive energy efficiency programs. And those programs have set this as part of their energy policy, if you will, for the state. And so they have very low application fees, and they use green banks or bond banks in order to finance the program. There are a lot of states like Minnesota, for example, who have taken much more of what they call the Main Street model, which is very private sector driven. They have absorbed the additional workload through their existing assessor staff and are relying on the private sector to market the program. The most popular approach seems to be kind of a hybrid of both, and that's what we have discussed and we anticipate being available in Alaska, that if a municipality chooses to bond, that ability is there, but this is just really another tool in the toolbox, and you can identify all these potential funding sources and then use this as the repayment mechanism.
Follow up, Representative Sadler.
So my question is, if municipalities do decide to go to bonding, would they be appealing to the bond bank authority, and in essence, would they be relying on the states of Alaska's positive credit rating to keep low interest bonds?
Because the issuance of general obligation bonds is specifically prohibited. It basically is a revenue bond. They would be going out basically pledging that the money that is loaned out and repaid along with the interest that is charged on that is then pledged to pay back those revenue bonds. They can assess an application fee or add a little quarter percentage point on the interest rate to cover any administrative costs, so it doesn't have to be any cost to the general fund of the municipality. But as an example, and we expect that if the mechanism is allowed, perhaps the first governmental units to figure out how to use it will be the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and for a couple of reasons. The conversion from natural or from fuel oil to natural gas, because natural gas appliances are so much more energy efficient, would qualify as an energy efficiency upgrade. In addition to changing over to use natural gas, if a business wants to change the windows, add some insulation, they can do that. We also have an air quality issue in Fairbanks, and we believe switching over to natural gas will be a huge part of satisfying that problem. And so the local government may determine that working in conjunction with the banks, it may be banks bringing in some money. There may be, because of that air quality issue, a desire for the local government to participate with a revenue bond. But it really is a mechanism for the local government, local businesses, and local lenders to come together to figure out, okay, how do we make this work at our local level? And we've not prescribed it exactly. We've sort of set a number of boxes to check so we get some uniformity across the state. But it really is for them to have that discussion locally. What is the problem that we're trying to solve? How do we potentially use this tool to get us there?
Right. And so the backing for the bonds, of course, would be the revenue. They would not be general obligation bonds of municipality.
That's correct.
Or the state.
That's specifically prohibited by the bank.
Hey, we've got quite a little bit of the presentation left, and then we'll have questions at the end. Go ahead, Ms. Ford.
The next two slides go over 060, and these are the definitions of the procedure to create the program. So if the municipality chooses to create a PACE program, the governing body must adopt a resolution of intent, and it must include all of these different elements. It must show that providing the PACE program serves a valid public purpose. The statement that the municipality intends to make PACE available to property owners, a description of qualified projects, available financing, the municipal debt servicing procedures, how the public can access a program report that's required in later statute, the public hearing requirements, and then also public contacts regarding the collection of the proposed contractual assessments.
And Mr. Chairman, on 060 for yourself and Representative Kawasaki, having served on municipal government, and I'm not sure if any of the others, Representative Wilson, of course, on the Borough Assembly.
Munoz.
There is the requirement that the municipality not go right to an ordinance to implement PACE. Before they can do that, they have to put out a resolution notifying the public that they intend to move forward with PACE, explain the PACE program that they intend to implement before they actually get to the introduction of an ordinance. So there is a requirement here for a real robust public discussion before they can go forward with the mechanism.
All right.
So the municipality must hold a public hearing with public comment and then adopt the ordinance with the terms of the program. Each aspect of the program can only be amended after another public hearing. The municipality may hire and set compensation for a program administrator and staff, and they may impose fees to offset the cost of administering the program to include an application fee and or a component of the interest rate. The next two slides go over 070. This is the publicly available program report. And so the report must include the map of the region boundaries, form contracts between the municipalities, third-party financiers, and the property owner, a description of qualified projects, a plan for ensuring sufficient capital, and if bonds were used, the report must include a maximum aggregate annual dollar amount for financing, a method for ranking requests from property owners, and a method for determining interest rate and the maximum amount of an assessment. It must also include a method for ensuring the repayment period does not extend the useful life of the qualified project. The report must also have a description of the application process and eligibility requirements, and a method for ensuring that qualified applicants can demonstrate financial ability to fulfill the financial obligations, that they're the legal owner of the property and current on their mortgage and property taxes and not insolvent or in bankruptcy. There should be an explanation of the assessment and collection process, the additional requirements for lender notice and review, marketing and educational services that will be provided, quality assurance and anti-fraud measures, collection procedures, and a requirement for an appropriate ratio between the assessment and the property value. And this report must be online and available to the public. 080 requires, as we have discussed earlier, the notice to the mortgage holder, and the mortgage holder must provide written they must be provided with written notice 30 days before the contract and provide written consent. 090 requires a third-party baseline energy audit with projected energy savings, and then once the projects are completed, the municipality shall obtain third-party verification that the project was properly completed and operating as intended. 100 allows direct acquisition of materials and products by the owner. 110 requires that the contractual assessment bids be noticed and filed by the municipality in the real property records. 120, contractual assessments and any interest or penalties are primary liens on the property. And this exclusions include municipal tax liens and special assessments. Enforcement is provided in existing statute. Contractual liens stay with the land and are not eliminated by foreclosure. Penalties and interest may be added to delinquent installments, and municipalities may cover costs and expenses, including attorney fees, to collect a delinquent installment. 130 allows governing bodies of municipalities to contract with another governing body of a taxing unit to collect assessments. So this could mean that, to use the Fairbanks example again, that the city of North Pole and the city of Fairbanks can contract together, or, you know, can contract with the borough in order to collect the assessments and then disperse them. 140, municipalities may issue bonds. These may not be general obligation bonds, and they must be secured by either payments of the contractual assessments, municipal reserves, municipal bond insurance, and any other funds lawfully available for purposes consistent with this chapter. The municipal pledge of assessments becomes the first lien, and these, if bonds are used, this must further a essential public and government purpose. 150 allows the joint implementation, so any combination of municipalities may jointly administer or hire a third-party administrator. This is extremely beneficial for smaller communities as well, who may not have the local capacity to be able to administer the program. 160 states that the program must be voluntary. Any municipality cannot compel a property owner to use PACE through any issuance of a permit, license, authorization, or anything else to the property owner. 890 allows the proposed PACE provisions to be available to home rule and general law municipalities. 900 adds the definitions. 995 adds the short title, and Section 5 establishes an immediate effective date.
So, Mr. Chairman, that that ends the overview and the running through the sectional analysis. We appreciate that you want to give this some thought. Again, by looking at and taking advantage of what other states learned as far as the necessity of some level of uniformity across the state, so that local lenders understand, in general, what does a PACE look like in Fairbanks? Is it about the same as Anchorage and Juneau? What Texas advised me was, when it was county to county and it varied tremendously, the local banks just said, we don't understand it enough. It's too specific to a municipality. We choose not to engage. But by bringing a certain level of uniformity, they understand and can gear up their in-house expertise to actually engage with local governments because of that general level of uniformity. We believe it is a mechanism that can be put to good use to help us bridge that gap and get businesses to actually move forward with energy efficiency improvements. Again, our audits, the audits that we have helped to fund, indicate that there can be substantial savings there. And through this mechanism, we believe individual businesses will see that even if they take on this debt and the obligation to repay, there's a very good chance that they will be cash positive on a yearly basis, being able to amortize and pay back that loan and still save energy savings on a yearly basis.
Also, we have online Mary Lynn McSalka from the Department of Law, in case you have any questions. And I also see we have Mayor Hopkins on the line. I think his testimony would probably be under public testimony the next time we have this bill up. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I ask this question in the spirit of wanting to make sure that this program is available because right now everything's available only for homes, for residences. So under this, and the definition of real property means privately owned commercial or industrial real property. Could it be a nonprofit? Could it be a charter school? Could it be a church? Could it be Alyeska trying to redo Pump 6? Where is the limit? I don't have an objection. Just trying to put the parameters about where it is. I've certainly had some nonprofits tell me they would love to retrofit their facility, save a lot of money, but there's no program available for them. So how far out does it go, and where are those sideboards?
I think it will depend somewhat on how that individual property is assessed at the local level. Is it considered to be a commercial building? As it is written, it would apply or be available for any of those things that you ticked off that are commercial or deemed to be commercial. For residential, generally, if you get to an apartment complex that is four units or higher or more than four units, that generally it's not operated as single-family dwelling or a duplex type thing, and it generally is operated as a commercial enterprise. And so it would be available for those larger apartment complexes, but not necessarily for a duplex.
Representative Guttenberg, again, it comes back from what is a commercial, but what also is a public facility? Would a private school be considered a public facility or not? We do have an AHFC program that does this same type of thing that has low-interest loans that are paid back by the savings out of that. So there's probably some question about which is what or will they qualify. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a commercial building, and I don't know if nonprofits are commercial or not. I'm sure that's in the definition. So they do this, they bond it out. If they can't repay it, does the property still go up for sale just like it would? Because I would assume that that's not necessarily true. So if I can't make the payments on this, but I can still make my property tax payment, what happens to the property?
It could go into foreclosure to guarantee that payment. It has all of the power of the repayment of the property tax.
Okay, follow up?
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
So let's say it goes up on, the tax foreclosure, and it doesn't sell for enough of whatever the loan is for. Who then has to pay that loan back?
Then it would obligation would stay with the property. So whoever eventually purchased that property out of foreclosure would take on that obligation.
Okay, so let's assume, Mr. Chair, that nobody does. So because with the obligation, it makes it to where no one wants to purchase it, and it stays with the borough now because maybe they got a loan that was bigger than anybody imagined. Now, is it still then the taxpayers of that borough to pay back?
It wouldn't fall to the taxpayer. If I think the financing was done through bonds, you can get insurance on the bond. There could be a default a pool that is generated through a slight fee that's captured on all of the loans to guarantee any defaults that are made. But again, because of the mechanism, because you do an audit to make sure that it's positive cash flow, you hopefully are, through the whole mechanism, lowering the chances that there will be defaults. And that's one of the benefits of going through this program is all those steps hopefully guarantee that it works out very positively for all businesses.
And Mr. Chair, I understand that, but I guess what I'm just trying to verify with the program is that worst case scenarios, let's say the budget keeps dropping and things take a turn and you still had all those savings. I'm just trying to figure out at any point, do the taxpayers of those municipalities have is there any chance they could ever come back to our property taxes to fulfill an obligation if the property didn't sell and somebody has to pay that bond? It's not going to be the business. It's going to have to come from the borough, I think, although that may be a slim chance. I just want to see whether or not at any point this could come back to the taxpayers.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe so. It's specifically not an obligation of the general taxpayers. It's an obligation of, if it's a revenue bond that's issued, the bond, the people that bought the bonds understand that it's the revenue that comes back. They then price the bonds accordingly, taking into consideration what they think the risk of non-payment is. And because the default rate on when you go through this mechanism is so low, that's all taken into consideration where the bonds are sold.
This verification, obviously I haven't bought bonds lately. So what you're basically saying is that if I bought revenue bonds in this, I would know there's a certain chance that I might not get as much money back that I anticipated if there was defaults to that.
That's correct. And before you entered into that agreement, you may require that a fee be charged to set up a pool of funds to guarantee that, or that there be something else that backstops any potential default.
I appreciate it. I just want to make sure that somehow the property owners, if somebody went zealously and started lending a lot of this money and things turned, you know, the wrong way, that our tax, you know, property tax owners wouldn't have to do it. Thank you.
Representative Kawasaki.
thank you, Mr. Chair. Just along the same lines of questioning regarding commercial and industrial property, I guess I can understand why there wouldn't be residential property linked into this. You know, just to point out, there's like a light commercial property that's zoned in my neighborhood. It's an urbanized neighborhood, but somehow the guy got away with it. It's a taxidermy shop. So it seems like, would that particular business qualify?
It may require a look at that specific property to see how the assessor in that particular municipality has assessed that.
And then follow up.
Follow up, Representative Kawasaki.
I guess why wouldn't you want to have this as broad as possible so that it would include, I mean, if it's a benefit to one property owner, it's probably a benefit to the other property owner next to them. And we have current legislation on local improvement districts. I think you passed it when you were mayor for the downtown area, downtown corridor, and that was sort of the concept was if you could get all of these property owners in this square to agree, then the city would take out some money to improve the downtown core area. It never went through as possible, and I think it's because there were a couple objectors in the crowd, but why wouldn't you want it to be as broad as possible?
Well, I think it is as broad as possible, especially with the changes made in CNRA. It's available to all businesses within the municipality's jurisdiction, but it's not mandatory. That's the big difference between an LID, where there is a vote that basically says every property or every lot in a specific area is going to pay this assessment. This mechanism comes at it through a different mechanism where it is available, but it is voluntary. Voluntary for the government to make it available and voluntary for the individual businesses to take advantage of it.
Follow up.
Why wouldn't you just create a local improvement district specifically for the purposes of energy get qualifying improvements that decrease energy consumption demand? Why wouldn't you just broaden it out and just say that if this whole neighborhood wants to go and get the same thing, I guess why wouldn't you do that? Like using the local improvement district scenario.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that mechanism is on the books. Yeah. It is available right now through the LID process, local improvement districts. There could be a blend of PACE available in the Fairbanks North Star Borough, but maybe in downtown Fairbanks, the businesses want to get together in the core Fairbanks and form an LID. I mean, there could be a blending of the two, but if you're going to have it borough-wide, there may be areas out in the Salter area that say, you know, we're not really interested, but maybe in downtown Fairbanks or Badger Road, they are, and you're leaving that flexibility for individual businesses to make that decision for their specific business.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Representative Munoz.
Follow up on that point, too. I think local improvement districts are for public improvements to that local area. So this is a private improvement to a private business, and so it would. I don't think you could use an LID process to make a private improvement.
No. Mr. Chairman, I think that's correct. Usually your LIDs are streetlights, sidewalks, water, sewer, gutters in the streets, something that's out in the public. Whereas this is improvements to somebody's private property.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Terrio and Ms. Ford. Appreciate it. And since we have no more questions, I will set House Bill 118 aside. We will have it back. And we're getting close to being done for the day. Our next House Finance meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, April 8th at 8:30 a.m. Set your alarms. At this meeting, we will continue to hear House Bill 148, where we will take further questions from the committee, and we will be addressing the fiscal notes. And with that, I adjourn this meeting at 3:14 p.m.